Chapter 4. Sacrifice. A single moment. Keep her safe. Wherever Erebus walked, shadows followed in his wake. Flickering whisperers were his constant companions, invisible creatures that lurked just beyond sight and ghosted in his shadow. The whisperers flitted from Erebus and gathered in the shadowed corners of the chamber. A stone-walled lodge built in the image of the temple room of the Delphos, where Akshub had cut his throat. Deep in the heart of the vengeful spirit, the lodge temple was low, close and hot, lit by a crackling fire that burned in a pit in the middle of the room. Flames threw leaping shapes across the walls.
"My war master," said Erebus, "we are prepared."
"Good," replied the war master. "It has cost us a great deal to reach this point, Erebus. For all our sakes, it had better be worth it. But mostly, for yours."
"It will be, War Master,"
assured Erebus, paying no heed to the threat.
"Our allies are keen to finally speak to you directly."
Erebus stooped to stare into the fire, the flames reflecting from his shaven, tattooed head and in the metal trim of his armor. As confident as he sounded, he allowed himself a moment of pause. Dealing with creatures from the warp was never straightforward, and should he fail to meet the War Master's expectations, then his life would be forfeit. The War Master's presence filled the lodge, armored as he was in a magnificent suit of obsidian terminator armor, gifted to him by the Fabricator General himself. Sent from Mars to cement the alliance between Horus and the Mechanicum of Mars, the armor echoed the colors of the elite Justerin, but it far surpassed them in ornamentation and power. The amber eye upon the breastplate stared from the armor's torso and shoulder plates, and on one hand Horus sported a monstrous gauntlet with deadly blades for fingers. Erebus lifted a book from beside the fire and rose to his feet, reverently turning the ancient pages until he came to a complex illustration of interlocking symbols.
"We are ready. I can begin once the sacrifice is made."
Horus nodded and said,
"Adept, join us."
Moments later, the bent and robed form of Adept Regulus entered the warrior lodge. The representative of the Mechanicum was almost completely mechanized, as was common among the higher echelons of his order. Beneath his robes, his body was fashioned from gleaming bronze, steel, and cables. Only his face showed, if it could be called a face, with large augmetic eyepieces and a vocabulator unit that allowed the adept to communicate. Regulus led the ghostly figure of Ing Mei Sing, her steps fearful and her hands flitting, as if swatting at a swarm of flies.
"This is unorthodox," said Regulus, his voice like steel wire on the nerves.
"Adept," said the War Master,
"you are here as the representative of the Mechanicum. The priests of Mars are essential to the Crusade, and they must be a part of the new order. You have already pledged your strength to me, and now it is time you witness the price of that bargain."
"War Master," began Regulus, "I am yours to command."
Horus nodded and said,
"Erebus, continue."
Erebus stepped past the War Master and directed his gaze towards Ing Mei Sing. Though the astropath was blind, she recoiled as she felt his eyes roaming across her flesh. She backed against one wall, trying to shrink away from him, but he grasped her arm in a crushing grip and dragged her towards the fire.
"She is powerful," said Erebus. "I can taste her."
"She is my best," said Horus.
"That is why it has to be her," said Erebus. "The symbolism is as important as the power. A sacrifice is not a sacrifice if it is not valued by the giver."
"No, please," cried Ing Mei Sing,
twisting in his grip as she realized the import of the word-bearer's statement. Horus stepped forwards and tenderly took hold of the astropath's chin, halting her struggles and tilting her head upwards so that she would have looked upon his face had she but eyes to see.
"You betrayed me, Mistress Sing," said Horus.
Ing Mei Sing whimpered, nonsensical protests spilling from her terrified lips. She tried to shake her head, but Horus held her firm and said,
"There is no point in denying it. I already know everything. After you told me of Euphratikila, you sent a warning to someone, didn't you? Tell me who it was, and I will let you live. Try to resist, and your death will be more agonizing than you can possibly imagine.
No,
whispered Ingmei Singh.
I am already dead. I know this. So kill me, and have done with it.
You will not tell me what I wish to know.
There is no point,
gasped Ingmei Singh.
You will kill me whether I tell you or not. You may have the power to conceal your lies, but your serpent does not.
Erebus watched as Horus nodded slowly to himself, as if reluctantly reaching a decision.
Then we have no more to say to one another,
said Horus sadly, drawing back his arm. He rammed his clawed gauntlet through her chest, the blades tearing through her heart and lungs and ripping from her back in a spray of red. Erebus nodded towards the fire, and the Warmaster held the corpse above the pit, letting Ingmei Singh's blood drizzle into the flames. The emotions of her death flooded the lodge as the blood hissed in the fire, hot, raw, and powerful. Fear, pain, and the horror of betrayal. Erebus knelt and scratched designs on the floor, copying them exactly from the diagrams in the book. A star with 8 points that was orbited by 3 circles, a stylized skull, and the cuneiform runes of Colchis.
You have done this before, said Horus.
Many times, said Erebus, nodding towards the fire. I speak here with my Primarch's voice, and it is a voice our allies respect.
They are not our allies yet, said Horus, lowering his arm and letting the body of Ingmei Singh slide from the claws of his gauntlet.
Erebus shrugged and began chanting words from the Book of Lorgar, his voice dark and guttural as he called upon the gods of the warp to send their emissary. Despite the brightness of the fire, the lodge darkened and Erebus felt the temperature fall, a chill wind gusting from somewhere unseen and unknown. It carried the dust of ages past and the ruin of empires in its every breath. An ageless eternity was born upon the unnatural zephyr.
Is this supposed to happen? Asked Regulus.
Erebus smiled and nodded without answering, as the air grew icy, the whisperers gibbering in unreasoning fear as they felt the arrival of something ancient and terrible. Shadows gathered in the corners of the room, although no light shone to cast them, and a racing whip of malicious laughter spiraled around the chamber. Regulus spun on hissing bearings as he sought to identify the source of the sounds, his ocular implants whirring as they struggled to find focus in the darkness. Frost gathered on the struts and pipes high above them. Horus stood unmoving as the shadows of the chamber hissed and spat, a chorus of voices that came from everywhere and nowhere.
You are the one your kind calls War Master.
Erebus nodded as Horus looked over at him.
I am,
said Horus.
War Master of the Great Crusade. To whom do I speak?
I am Sarkel,
said the voice.
Lord of the Shadows.
The three of them made their way swiftly through the decks of the Vengeful Spirit, heading down towards the tiled environment of the Medicaid deck. Cinderman kept the pace as brisk as he could, his breath sharp and painful as they hurried to save the saint from whatever dark fate awaited her.
"What do you expect to find when we reach the saint, Iterator?"
asked Jonah Arukan, his nervous hands fingering the catch on his pistol holster. Cinderman thought of the small Medicaid cell where he and Mercedy Ollerton had stood vigil over Euphrate, and wondered that same thought.
"I don't know exactly," he said. I just know we have to help.
I just hope a frail old man and our pistols are up to the job.
What do you mean?
Asked Cinderman, as they descended a wide screw stair that led deeper into the ship.
Well, I just wonder how you plan to fight the kind of danger that could threaten a saint. I mean, whatever it is must be pretty damn dangerous, yes?
Cinderman paused in his descent, as much to catch his breath as to answer Arukin.
"Whoever sent me that warning obviously thinks that I can help," he said.
And that's enough for you? Asked Arukin. Jonah, leave him alone, cautioned Titus Kassar.
No, damn it, I won't, said Arukin. This is serious, and we could get in real trouble. I mean, this Keeler woman, she's supposed to be all saintly, yes? Then why doesn't the power of the Emperor save her? Why does he need us?
The Emperor works through his faithful servants, Jonah, explained Titus. It's not enough to simply believe and await divine intervention to sweep down from the heavens and set the world to rights. The Emperor has shown us the path, and it is up to us to seize this chance to do his will.
Sinderman watched the exchange between the two crewmen, his anxiety growing with every second that passed.
I don't know if I can do this, Titus, said Arukin. Not without some proof that we're doing the right thing.
We are, Jonah, pressed Titus. You must trust that the Emperor has a plan for you.
The Emperor may or may not have a plan for me, but I sure as hell do, snapped Arukin. I want command of a Titan, and that's not going to happen if we get caught doing something stupid.
Please, cut in Sinderman, his chest hurting with worry for the Saint. We have to go. Something terrible is coming to harm her, and we have to stop it. I can think of no more compelling an argument than that. I'm sorry, but you'll just have to trust me.
Why should I? Asked Arukin. You've given me no reason to. I don't even know why I'm here.
Listen to me, Mr. Arukin, said Sinderman earnestly. When you live as long and complex a life as I have, you learn that it always comes down to a single moment, a moment in which a man finds out once and for all who he really is. This is that moment, Mr. Arukin. Will this be a moment you are proud to look back on, or will it be one you will regret for the rest of your life?
The two Titan crewmen shared a glance, and eventually Arukin sighed and said,
I need my head looked at for this, but all right, let's go save the day.
A palpable sense of relief flooded through Sinderman, and the pain in his chest eased.
I am proud of you, Mr. Arukin, he said. And I thank you. Your aid is most welcome.
Thank me when we save this saint of yours, said Arukin, setting off down the stairs.
They followed the stairs down, passing several decks, until the symbol of intertwined serpents around a winged staff indicated they had arrived at the Medicaid deck. It had been some weeks since the last casualties had been brought aboard the Vengeful Spirit, and the sterile, gleaming wilderness of tiled walls and brushed steel cabinets felt empty, a warren of soulless glass rooms and laboratories.
This way, said Sinderman, setting off into the confusing maze of corridors,
the way familiar to him after all the times he had visited the comatose imagist. Kassar and Arukin followed him, keeping a watchful eye out for anyone who might challenge their presence. At last, they reached a nondescript white door, and Sinderman said,
This is it.
Arukin said, Better let us go first, old man.
Sinderman nodded and backed away from the door, pressing his hands over his ears as the two Titan crewmen unholstered their pistols. Arukin crouched low beside the door and nodded to Kassar, who pressed the release panel. The door slid aside, and Arukin spun through it with his pistol extended. Kassar was a second behind him, his pistol tracking left and right for targets, and Sinderman awaited the deafening flurry of pistol shots. When none came, he dared to open his eyes and uncover his ears. He didn't know whether to be glad or deathly afraid that they were too late. He turned and looked through the door, seeing the familiar clean and well-maintained Medicaid cell he had visited many times. Euphrate lay like a mannequin on the bed, her skin like alabaster and her face pinched and sunken. A pair of drips fed her fluids, and a small, bleeping machine drew spiking lines on a green display unit beside her. Aside from her immobility, she looked just as she had the last time he had laid eyes on her.
Just as well we rushed, snapped Arukin. Looks like we were just in time.
I think you might be right, said Sinderman, as he saw the golden-eyed figure of Maggard come into view at the far end of the corridor, with his sword unsheathed. You are known to us, Warmaster, said Sarkel, his voice leaping around the room like a capricious whisper. It is said that you are the one who can deliver us. Is that true?
Perhaps, replied Horus, apparently unperturbed by the strangeness of his unseen interlocutor. "My brother Lorgar assures me that your masters can give me the power to achieve victory."
"Victory," whispered Sarkel. "An almost meaningless word in the scale of the cosmos. But yes, we have much power to offer you. No army will stand before you. No power of mortal man will lay you low. And no ambition will be denied you if you swear yourself to us."
"Just words," said Horus. "Show me something tangible."
"Power,"
hissed Sarkel, the sound rippling around Horus like a slithering snake.
"The warp brings power. There is nothing beyond the reach of the gods of the warp."
"Gods," replied Horus. "You waste your time throwing such words around. They do not impress me. I already know that your gods need my help. So speak plainly, or we are done here."
"Your emperor,"
replied Sarkel, and for a fleeting moment Erebus detected a trace of unease in the creature's voice. Such entities were unused to the defiance of a mortal, even one as mighty as a Primarch.
"He meddles in matters he does not understand. On the world you call Terra, his grand designs cause a storm in the warp that tears it asunder from within. We care nothing for your realm. You know this. It is anathema to us. We offer power that can help you take his place, War Master. Our aid will see you destroy your foes and take you to the very gates of the Emperor's palace. We can deliver the galaxy to you. All we care for is that his works cease and that you take his place."
The unseen voice spoke in sibilant tones, slick and persuasive, but Erebus could see that Horus was unmoved. "And what of this power? Do you understand the magnitude of this task? The galaxy will be divided. Brother will fight brother. The Emperor will have his legions and the Imperial Army, the Custodian Guard, the Sisters of Silence. Can you be the equal of such a foe?"
"The gods of the warp are masters of the primal forces of all reality. As your Emperor creates, the warp decays and destroys. As he brings us to battle, we shall melt away. And as he gathers his strength, we shall strike from the shadows. The victory of the gods is as inevitable as the passing of time and the mortality of flesh. Do the gods not rule an entire universe hidden from your eyes, War Master? Have they not made the warp dark at their command?"
"Your gods did this?
Why? You have blinded my legions."
"Necessity, War Master. The darkness blinds the Emperor too, blinds him to our plans and yours. The Emperor thinks himself the master of the warp, and he would seek to know his enemies by it. But see how swiftly we can confound him. You will have passage through the warp as you need it, War Master, for as we bring darkness, so we can bring light."
"The Emperor remains ignorant of all that has transpired."
"Completely,"
sighed Sarkel.
"And so, War Master, you see the power we can give you. All that remains is for your word, and the pact will be made."
Horus said nothing, as if weighing up the choices before him, and Erebus could sense the growing impatience of the warp creature. At last, the War Master spoke again.
"Soon I shall unleash my legions against the worlds of the Istvan system. There I shall set my legions upon the path of the new crusade. There are matters that must be dealt with at Istvan, and I will deal with them in my own way."
Horus looked over at Erebus and said, "When I am done with Istvan, I will pledge my forces with those of your masters, but not until then."
My legions will go through the fire of Istvan alone, for only then will they be tempered into my shining blade, aimed at the Emperor's heart. The sibilant, roiling chill of Sarkel's voice hissed as if he took mighty breaths.
My masters, accept, he said at last. You have chosen well, War Master.
The chill wind that had carried the words of the warp entity blew again, stronger this time, its ageless malevolence like the murder of innocence. Its icy touch slid through Erebus, and he drew a cold breath before the sensation faded and the unnatural darkness began to recede, the light of the fire once more illuminating the lodge temple. The creature was gone, and the void of its presence was an ache felt deep in the soul.
"Was it worth it, War Master?" asked Erebus, releasing the pent-up breath he had been holding.
"Yes," said Horus,
glancing down at Ing Mei Sing's body.
"It was worth it."
The War Master turned to Regulus and said, "Adept, I wish the Fabricator General to be made aware of this. I cannot contact him directly, so you will take a fast ship and make for Mars. If what this creature says is true, you will make good time. Kelbor Hal is to purge his order and make ready for its part in my new crusade. Tell him that I shall contact him when the time comes, and that I expect the Mechanicum to be united."
"Of course, War Master. Your will be done."
"Waste no time, Adept. Go."
Regulus turned to leave, and Erebus said,
"We have waited a long time for this day. Lorgar will be exultant."
"Lorgar has his own battles to fight, Erebus," replied Horus sharply. "As do you. Begin making your preparations now. All this will be for nothing if Gilliman's legion is allowed to intervene. Save your celebrations for when I sit upon the throne of terror."
Cinderman felt his heart lurch in his chest at the sight of Petronella's bodyguard coming towards them. The man's every step was like death approaching, and Cinderman cursed himself for having taken so long to get here. His tardiness had killed the saint, and would probably see them all dead as well. Jonah Arukan's eyes widened as he saw the massive form of the saint's killer approaching. He turned quickly and said,
"Titus, grab her, now!"
"What?" asked Kassar. "She's hooked up to all these machines. We can't just..."
"Don't argue with me," hissed Arukan. "Just do it. We've got company. Bad company."
Arukan turned back to Cinderman and hissed,
"Well, iterator, is this that single moment you were talking about, where we find out who we really are? If it is, then I'm already regretting helping you."
Cinderman couldn't reply. He saw Maggard notice them outside Euphrates' room, and felt a cold, creeping horror as a slow smile spread across the man's features. "I'm going to kill you," the smile said, slowly.
"Don't hurt her," he whispered,
the words sounding pathetic in his ears.
"Please."
He wanted to run, to get far away from the evil smile that promised a silent, agonizing death. But his legs were lead weights, rooted to the spot by some immense power that prevented him from moving so much as a muscle. Jonah Arukan slid from the Medicaid cell, with Titus Kassar behind him, the recumbent form of Euphrates in his arms. Dripping tubes dangled from her arms, and Cinderman found his gaze unaccountably drawn to the droplets as they swelled at the ends of the plastic tubes, before breaking free and plummeting to the deck to splash in crowns of saline. Arukan held his pistol out before him, aimed at Maggard's head.
"Don't come any closer," he warned.
Maggard did not even slow down, and that same deathly smile shone at Jonah Arukan. With Euphrates still in his arms, Titus Kassar backed away from the relentlessly approaching killer.
"Come on, damn it," he hissed. "Let's go."
Arukan shoved Cinderman after Kassar, and suddenly the spell of immobility that had held him rooted to the spot was broken. Maggard was less than 10 paces from them, and Cinderman knew that they could not hope to escape without bloodshed.
"Shoot him!" shouted Kassar.
"What?"
asked Arukan, throwing his fellow crewman a desperate glance.
"Shoot him!" repeated Kassar. "Kill him before he kills us!"
Jonah Arukan tore his gaze back to the approaching Maggard and nodded, pulling the trigger twice in quick succession. The noise was deafening, and the corridor was filled with blinding light and careening echoes. Tiles shattered and exploded as Arukan's bullets cratered the wall behind where Maggard had been standing. Cinderman cried out at the noise, backing away after Titus Kassar, as Maggard spun out from the sunken doorway in which he had taken cover the instant before Arukan had fired. Maggard's pistol leapt to his hand, and the barrel blazed with light as he fired three times. Cinderman cried out, throwing up his arms and awaiting the awful pain of bullets tearing into his flesh, ripping through his internal organs and blowing bloody-rimmed craters in his back. Nothing happened, and Cinderman heard a cry of astonishment from Jonah Arukan, who had likewise flinched at the thunderous noise of Maggard's gun. He lowered his arms, and his mouth fell open in amazement at the sight before him. Maggard still stood there, his muscled arms still holding his wide-barreled pistol aimed squarely at them. A frozen bloom of light expanded at an infinitesimally slow pace from the muzzle, and Cinderman could see a pair of bullets held immobile in the air before them, only the glint of light on metal as they spiraled giving any sign that they were moving at all. As he watched, the pointed nub of a brass bullet began to emerge from the barrel of Maggard's gun, and Cinderman turned in bewilderment to Jonah Arukan. The Titan crewman was as shocked as he was, his arms hanging limply at his side.
"What the hell is going on?" breathed Arukan. "I don't know," stammered Cinderman, unable to tear his gaze from the frozen tableau standing in front of them. "Maybe we're already dead."
"No, Iterator," said Kassar from behind them. "It's a miracle."
Cinderman turned, feeling as if his entire body was numb, only his heart hammering fit to break his chest. Titus Kassar stood at the end of the corridor, the saint held tightly to his chest. Where before Euphrates had lain supine, her eyes were now wide in terror, her right hand extended, and the silver eagle that had been burned into her flesh glowing with a soft inner light.
"Euphrates!"
cried Cinderman. But no sooner had he given voice to her name than her eyes rolled back in their sockets and her hand dropped to her side. He risked a glance back at Maggard, but the assassin was still frozen by whatever power had saved their lives. Cinderman took a deep breath and made his way on unsteady legs to the end of the corridor. Euphrates lay with her head against Kassar's chest, as unmoving as she had been for the last year, and he wanted to weep to see her so reduced. He reached up and ran a hand through Euphrates' hair, her skin hot to the touch.
"She saved us," said Kassar,
his voice awed and humbled by what he had seen.
"I think you might be right, my dear boy," said Cinderman. "I think you might be right."
Jonah Arukan joined him, alternating between casting fearful looks at Maggard and Euphrates. He kept his pistol trained on Maggard and said,
"What do we do about him?"
Cinderman looked back at the monstrous assassin and said,
"Leave him. I will not have his death on the saint's hands. What kind of beginning would it be for the Lictitio Divinitatis if the saint's first act is to kill? If we are to found a new church in the name of the emperor, it will be one of forgiveness, not bloodshed."
"Are you sure?" asked Arukan. "He will come after her again."
"Then we will keep her safe from him," said Kassar. "The Lictitio Divinitatis has friends aboard the vengeful spirit, and we can hide her until she recovers. Iterator, do you agree?"
"Yes, that's what to do," nodded Cinderman. "Hide her. Keep her safe."